It's my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Kitty Verdolini. Did I say that right, Kitty? Great. And she's going to talk to us today about the voice science and neurology and how that all connects with what we're doing as singers.
Motor learning.
Motor learning, yes. So, again, take your seats and please join me in welcoming Kitty Verdolini.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here in Minneapolis. What a beautiful city. And it's so nice to be among so many singers. I spend much of my time among scientists, who are also nice folks, but sometimes it's nice to have a change, and there's a different feeling to the crowd when there are singers involved. So it's really delightful for me to be able to be here, and I thank you for being here yourselves. I'm going to be talking about releasing learning myths and truths in singing, or rather more generally, voice training. First of all, I'd like to introduce you to my fair city, Pittsburgh. I'm at the University of Pittsburgh. And people don't usually think of Pittsburgh in this way, because we think of Pittsburgh with its smokestacks and its steel mills, but they're all gone, and it's a lovely, lovely city. But don't tell anybody, because then everyone will move there and we'll have a lot of traffic and prices will go up. I'd like to also introduce you to my doctoral students, without whom I could get virtually nothing done, but who also take a lot of time from me, but I love them dearly. So we'll start right off by talking about the typical focus in singing training. The typical focus in singing training usually has to do with the what of training. So you go to one teacher, and that one teacher might have a certain view about what is an optimal posture, what is the optimal breathing mechanism, what do we do with registration and vowel modification, et cetera, et cetera. And most teachers have their pet views on all of these issues, and we focused very much on these issues in singing training. And our selection around these issues has to do with our pedagogical school. Most of you are probably familiar with Richard Miller's description of the English, French, Italian, and German pedagogical schools of singing training. What we choose to focus on is also reflected by our personal experience, and sometimes by voice science studies, as many of you may have heard from Ron Shear and others this morning. My history with the question has to do with my practice as both a teacher of singing and a speech-language pathologist. In my first couple of years as a speech-language pathologist, when I was also a teacher of singing for the first couple of years, I encountered this really interesting phenomenon that at first annoyed me. And this was the phenomenon. I would be standing across from a person or sitting across from a person, and I would say, ah, and the person would go, ah, no. Ah, 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 ah. And it was really annoying because, you know, because that person was maybe 2 feet away and looking me straight in the eyes. And I'm thinking, there is a big gap here. There is a big gulf here. Where is this information going? There was this black hole between the two of us, right? And for a long time it annoyed me, and then it started to interest me. I started to think, what's that gap about? How can I get the information that's in my body to that body? And by the way, I can assure you that most of my voice teachers, I'm sure, had the same experience relative to me. And in fact, just a little anecdote here is that, have I ever studied with anybody in this room? I don't think so. Just wanted to make sure. Okay. Well, I studied with a lot of people from the age of about 14 on, and with every singing teacher, I got better, but always within the same category. So if you consider, there's three categories of singers: god-awful, mediocre, and good, right? Let's just take that as a basic categorization of singers. I always got better within the mediocre category. And let me tell you, I got to be the best damn mediocre singer you have ever heard in your life. But I never broke out of that category until I started studying with a certain Dr. Mark Madsen at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. And let me just tell you a little story about my first lesson with Mark. I was actually already a member of NATS, a teacher myself, but I wanted to study again. And I'd done a lot of juries and competitions as a judge. And there was something about his students. They all sounded different. They all had their own unique sound, but there was something they had in common. There was a freedom, a power, a something. And I knew that not all of them had been that way when they started to study with him. So I decided I wanted to study with him. I was a doctoral student, didn't have much money. It was $40 an hour. We're talking 1985. It was a lot of money for me. Walked into my first lesson. He's at the piano. He plays a little scale, and I replicate what he wants me to do. Nothing. I got nothing out of this man. And I'm thinking, I'm paying 40 bucks here. I want a little action. Nothing. Not a twinkle of an eye, not a down curling of the side of the mouth, not a raising of an eyebrow. Nothing. And after several minutes, I started thinking, you know, somebody's got to do something here. And if it's not going to be him, I guess it'll have to be me. So I put on my thinking cap and I started working on whatever I thought I needed to be working on. About 10 minutes later, he gets up out of his chair, grabs the back of my neck, rearranges my anatomy relative to gravity, right? Has me sing it again. It sounded different. He sits down. We do another 10 minutes like this. I had really bad lessons with Mark Mattson, and the only reason that I stuck with him was because of his reputation. I said, something going on here. And it was months before I started to improve. But once I started to improve, the whole place exploded. And I broke out of the mediocre category, as evidenced by being able to at least audition with dignity for regional oratorios and what have you. And the point is that I had bad lessons, but I learned well. And lots of times, when I'm going to talk to you about some of the mechanisms behind that today, but a lot of times we'll find that the motor learning literature tells us that good lessons mean bad learning. And in fact, with every other teacher that I had before, I tended to have really good lessons because I was using their brain. And their brain was going right around mine, and as long as they were standing there with me, I could do it. But when I went into the practice room, I couldn't anymore, and I just felt badly about myself. I just felt incompetent. I felt that they were great teachers, but I was a bad singer. With Mark, I wasn't so sure he was such a good teacher, but all of a sudden, I was a good singer by my own evaluation. Thank you very much. You might not all agree. But at any rate, so that is the gulf that started to interest me. What is happening in that space? How come I was having such bad lessons with Mark, but ultimately, I started to sing well? So, in fact, I became interested in the how of training. How do people acquire new physical behaviors? Especially, how do we acquire new physical behaviors that override existing ones, right? And this is a challenge for us as singing teachers. And this is especially relevant for behaviors in teensy-tiny muscles that we can't see. Did you ever think of it? We're used to seeing the vocal folds all illuminated on big screens now, but did you ever think about it? They're only about a centimeter and a half long, and they're actually vibrating in the dark. Could you imagine what life from the perspective of the vocal folds must look like? As I'm talking right now, there must be this intermittent light coming down there, but the whole thing must be carried out very differently from how we usually think of it, from looking at stroboscopy and what have you. And so we are often talking about people making adjustments of fractions of millimeters in this tissue, which will make all the difference between getting that gig and not getting that gig, in structures that we can't see. I think we have a greater challenge than many other physical trainers in that regard. And in any event, the question became interesting for me, sufficiently interesting for me, that I pursued a PhD in cognitive science and motor learning. In this talk, I'm going to talk about mechanisms involved in acquiring new motor patterns and overriding old ones. Most of the literature that I'm going to talk to you about, although not all of it, but much of the literature that I'll talk to you about doesn't come from singing training or even voice training, because very little has been done in this domain, and most of what's been done, I've done, and that's not very much. We're going to start with a definition of motor learning. This is going to seem really annoying, but you'll see that it's really important. We're going to talk about some of the key cognitive mechanisms in motor learning. It's important for us to know something about those cognitive mechanisms because that's what we're going to be manipulating a lot of in training. We're going to be talking about laws of practice, how we can structure practice sessions to influence motor learning in singing training. And we're going to be talking about implications for voice training and implications for our own personal myths. And I have a lot of material today, so I may be skipping through some of the slides quickly in order to focus on some other ones that I think are key. So, definitions. Motor learning is a set of processes associated with practice or experience leading to relatively permanent changes in the capability for movement. Let me break this down for you and tell you why each clause is important. First of all, motor learning is a set of processes that we can't observe. Okay? Learning isn't something that is, it's not a structure that's sitting in the head. It's a process that occurs in the head. It is associated with practice or experience or exposure. That means that if I take some kind of a drug before I perform and all of a sudden I perform better, we can't attribute that performance improvement to learning. Okay? The third point is a really, really important one, and I already sort of introduced it. And that is that motor learning is a set of processes that lead to relatively permanent changes in the capacity for movement. And that's important because we're going to see that if we think of learning as what's happening during a singing, during a lesson, okay, it's not learning. Because in order to know whether it's learning, we have to see that it is stable over time. Otherwise, it's just a performance shift. And herein lies the problem that I experienced before, and that is that I would have performance shifts because of what my teachers were doing during my lessons, but I wasn't learning. And we're going to see that some of the things that we can do to enhance immediate performance and feel really good about ourselves as teachers and have our students feel really good about us as teachers are exactly those things that inhibit learning. So we may need to learn how to have sufficient ego to be able to stand students having bad lessons if we want to see them starting to improve over time and to retain those performance shifts over time. And motor learning further is a set of processes leading to relatively permanent changes in the general capability for movement. So you might have an audition that doesn't go quite as well as another. We can't say that you have unlearned something, but we're looking in general, when we're talking about learning, we're talking about the general overall average capability for movement. So for me, as I said before, am I in the mediocre category or am I in the good category? And in fact, let me just reiterate this point that as we will see shortly in our discussion of laws of practice, we will see that things we do in the studio to improve immediate performance may mess up learning seen in the long term. And things that we can do in the studio to mess up immediate performance may be exactly those that lead to learning in the long term. Also of interest is the concept that when we're talking about motor learning, we're really talking about perceptual motor learning. And motor learning is just a shortcut way of saying that. In other words, perception is critically important to the motor learning process. And this is seen, for example, in a lot of studies on the neurological substrates of motor learning. Here we have sort of a summary slide in a review article by Cabeza and Nyberg from 2000. And we have, this is the left side of the brain and this is the right side of the brain. All of these dots here represent activation areas for different motor and procedural learning tasks that have been studied under imaging sort of conditions, none of them having to do with voice, but for a variety of different physical tasks. And for those of you who have some familiarity with the brain, the posterior brain, which is here on the left hemisphere, and then here for the right hemisphere, the posterior cortex is perceptual cortex. And the anterior cortex is the motor cortex. And you can see that most of the dots here involved in motor learning or procedural learning are seen in the perceptual cortices rather than in the motor cortices. So a lot of what we're training is actually perception and ability to judge, to feel awareness of one's own body in space. Now, if we're going to talk about cognitive mechanisms in motor learning, we have to identify some sort, it would be helpful if we identify some sort of a model, some sort of a framework within which to investigate these mechanisms. And there are different frameworks and models that are available. One of my favorite frameworks is the one that I'm going to use today in talking to you. And this model has to do with the distinction between what's called declarative learning and procedural learning. Can you raise your hand if you've ever heard about this distinction? Okay, good, a few people. Declarative learning is defined as memory for specific events and general facts about the world. So if I ask you, what did you have for breakfast this morning, and you report back to me what you had for breakfast, that would be a declarative memory. You declare it. In fact, we see declarative memory. We know that it's present by your verbal reports, okay? And procedural learning, on the other hand, is not seen by people's verbal reports. It's seen in their actions. So if I want to know if you know how to ride a bike, okay, which would reflect a procedural memory, I don't ask you how to ride a bike. I would ask you to get on a bike and see how you do. And if you don't fall off, I would assume that you have memory, you have learned that procedure. So procedural learning is not seen, or it's not reflected by verbal report. It's reflected by performance. What is the evidence of this distinction? Who says that this is a real distinction? Well, there is neurological evidence of this distinction. The distinction has been made in the literature as early as Plato, if you go back that far, and probably earlier, but there's written descriptions of this distinction as early as Plato. But in the contemporary era, a new interest in this distinction was generated by this patient, H.M., in Montreal. H.M. at the time was probably about 17 years old, a young man who was 17 years old, and he had intractable epilepsy. He was having upwards of 40 grand mal seizures a day. And everything had been tried to control these seizures. No treatment was successful. And so it was decided to do a bilateral temporal lobectomy, which means removing this part of the cortex on both sides. And it is known that doing that will resolve epilepsy, because that's kind of where epilepsy lives. But it's also known that in taking away this part of the cortex, that individuals will afterwards be unable to acquire new memories for events or facts about the world. And in fact, they acquire anterograde amnesia. And in fact, H.M. had very dense anterograde amnesia for the rest of his life. I believe he just died. This was in 1958 or so. And he couldn't remember anything that had happened after his surgery, or for a few years before, for that matter. But it might be folklore, it might be true, I'm not sure. But folklore says that it was the occupational therapist who started to notice something very curious. She'd go to his room every day to get him and take him to the activities room where they'd play games. And he didn't know who she was. She had to introduce herself every day. When they got to the game, she had to direct him, you know, to a specific game that he'd played before. But she noticed that day after day, he was improving on the game, although he didn't remember that he had ever done it before. And she apparently reported this to the neurologist, Brenda Milner, who thought that was a very interesting thing, and started investigating, or started looking into, once again, this distinction between what H.M. had lost, and that is declarative memory, versus what he had retained, which was procedural memory. He could readily learn new motor behaviors, for example. And the neurological distinction is that the declarative learning depends on the hippocampus and the amygdala, whereas procedural learning does not depend on the hippocampus and the amygdala. And the hippocampus and the amygdala are the structures that are removed in bilateral temporal lobectomy. So we have an anatomical distinction between the structures that govern these two types of memories. And the implication is that book learning and motor learning, in fact, depend on different neuroanatomical substrates. Declarative memory depends on the hippocampus and the amygdala, and procedural memory does not depend on the hippocampus and the amygdala. A further implication, which is really, really wonderful to contemplate, is that motor learning can and does occur without conscious memory of prior training. So it occurs, if not outside of consciousness, at the time of later performance. There is no necessary memory of what we have learned. So if I have learned to use my abdomen in a certain way in singing, when I go to demonstrate that learning by later singing, any notions that I have around what my abdomen is doing are irrelevant to my ability to perform. that abdominal movement. And in fact, there are some very nice studies by Hickson and Watson and some folks from that group that show that when singers are asked what they are doing with their respiratory system and you compare what they say to traces of what they're actually doing, they're all over the map. They're clueless. Same for palate. Which doesn't mean that there's not value to explaining things in a certain way, maybe, although I'm gonna argue against that a bit. But the notion is that not only with motor learning in general, but with singing in particular, people's notions or their verbal reports about what they are doing are often wrong. And this goes along with the notion that motor learning for singing occurs largely outside of awareness, outside of consciousness. So what are the further cognitive characteristics of the thing, of the system that learns motor things? I'm going to go through some key characteristics of the motor learning system, cognitive characteristics, and we're going to talk about the evidence, and we're going to talk about what these characteristics might mean for the way that we train people in singing. And I'm just a little disclaimer here. I'm going to act as though these two systems are entirely independent in their cognitive and neuroanatomical characteristics. That is a bit of a simplification, but it is close enough that I'm comfortable making it in this kind of a venue. First of all, let's go through the list quickly, and then we'll talk about the underlined, bolded, and italicized items in greater detail. Declarative learning, by definition, involves consciousness, whereas, by definition, procedural learning does not involve consciousness, even when people think that they can verbally report or are aware or conscious of what they have learned. This is the definition of the two types of learning. Declarative learning depends on associational processes. So, for example, if I want to remember somebody's name at a cocktail party, and the guy's name is Giovanni Smith, and I want to remember Giovanni Smith, I might associate this person with Don Giovanni because he kind of looks like him, okay? And if I make that kind of an association, I am more likely to remember his name later than if I don't make that kind of association. And it is very clear from the cognitive science literature, there's just overwhelming evidence of this kind of a link. And let me show you where associational processes generally occur. Associational processes usually involve a convergence of information in what are called associational cortices, right here at the juncture of parietal, occipital, and temporal cortices are typically associational cortices. So that's where declarative learning depends on that kind of processing, whereas procedural learning is very strongly thought to depend on much more elementary perceptual processes, which would be found in the primary or integrated or nearby perceptual cortices, so temporal, occipital, and parietal. So that's a distinction. There's a different kind of processing that feeds into declarative learning versus procedural learning. And there are some very interesting and perhaps upsetting data around that relative to voice that I'll be going into. A third differentiation is that declarative learning depends on intention, usually. If you're going to learn something for a test, you usually have to intend to learn it. You usually have to study it, do associational processing to remember things. You know, there's little acronyms that you develop to help, mnemonics that you develop to help you remember things for a test. Whereas much procedural learning is actually incidental. And I will show you some data that indicate that too much intention in motor learning can be a problem. And you are all probably familiar with that phenomenon of people trying too hard. So in other words, you're going to have to intend to hit a certain note, but trying too hard is a problem. And we're going to go into some data around that. Declarative learning is actually, it depends on a very, very painfully slow serial processor. Consciousness, and that is consciousness, we can hold 7 ± 2 things in consciousness, juggling them at any one span of time. I'm sure many of you have heard about that little fact. And we process bits of information in consciousness extremely slowly. I want to say on the order of about 100 milliseconds, which in neurological or cognitive times is really slow. And we can only process them one after the other. We can't process any of them at the same time. In fact, we can only think of one thing at a time, though we can hold 7 ± 2 on the workbench of consciousness for a span of time. But we can only process one item of information at a time. But the system is very flexible because it's so slow. We can pick out one piece of something roaming around in consciousness and replace it with something else and restructure what we have in consciousness. The same cannot be said for motor learning. Motor learning depends on a system, on a neurological system that has virtually unlimited capacity. There's none of this 7 plus or minus 2 stuff. It's unfathomable, the capacity it has. It's very fast, and it processes information all in parallel, all at once, which is logical for a motor learning system, because if you just think of the number of commands that are needed to walk from here to the end of the stage, the number of commands that have to be played out all at once in relation to each other is staggering, and they can't fit in consciousness, which is one of the problems, I believe, that we encounter when we try to instruct people verbally, analytically, trying to get them to use a mechanical consciousness, is we have those 7 plus or minus 2 bits of information to work with, and there's many more than 7 bits of information that have to be used to get this job done. Declarative learning is what's called phylogenetically and ontogenetically new or recent. Phylogenetics refers to the development of the species. Ontogenetics refers to the development of an individual human. And so, for example, if you buy into evolution, consciousness is assumed to have appeared relatively recently in the evolutionary scale. And consciousness also appears relatively late in the development of the individual human. Consciousness doesn't develop until, we don't have the neural machinery for it until at least 9 months of age, and most of us don't remember anything consciously until we're about 3 or 4 years old, right? And we don't remember anything before we were about 3 years old. So that's a quite late developing sort of a system neurologically. Whereas the system procedural learning is phylogenetically and ontogenetically very, very old. You can show evidence of procedural learning in amoebas, in single-cell organisms. And you can show evidence of procedural learning in fetuses from a very, very, very young fetal age. I want to say certainly three months of age, of fetal of gestational age. Both declarative learning and procedural learning, however, share the characteristic that they are both attention dependent, although the quality of that attention may be different, and they are both repetition dependent. Okay, so let's start talking about some of these characteristics, which are really fun. And it's funny because when I've given similar talks in theater groups, the theater people often tell me that this information has given them tools with which they can explain to their dean what they're doing, because they already do it, right? They already do it, but now they have a little bit of words to lay on it. Many of you singing teachers may already be following models that are going to emerge from this literature, but for some of you, this stuff may be a little upsetting. So we'll see what you think. Attention. Attention has gained a lot of interest within about 8 years in the literature. The first study that I'm aware of that's going to be looking at it with respect to singing and voice training is being set up by one of my doctoral students right now, Doug Roth. So all of the studies that I will talk to you about are studies from other motor domains, but I believe very strongly that they apply to, the results apply to voice training. On this side of the screen, you see this guy on this strange-looking apparatus. It's a ski simulator. And on the ski simulator, the person's job is to move back and forth across the platform as quickly as possible with the largest possible amplitude, so all the way to the right and all the way to the left. People don't do experiments with this particular device much anymore because a lot of subjects were falling off of it. But prior to these problems becoming obvious, there was evidence from these studies that when subjects were told what to do with their legs, in other words, specifically when, at what point in this arc they should shift their weight from their left to their right foot, in other words, they were given correct biomechanical information about how to do the task, subjects loved the information, they thought it was very helpful, and they were dead wrong. People performed better and they learned better when they were left alone and they were said, platform, you, on, go. Okay? Although they didn't feel that they had gotten their money's worth, if you will, they performed and they learned much better. And I'm going to be talking about some evidence of that relative to voice in just a moment. So people started to ask, we wonder if instructions, and there were several studies to this effect, there wasn't just one study, there were several replications. People started to ask, we wonder if giving people mechanical instructions is bad for learning because it's bad to pay attention to your body. Maybe what you need to do, maybe they get you hyper, maybe it gets you tense, maybe all you need to do is pay attention to something outside of your body, and if you do that, you will learn better. And in fact, I have colleagues in Northern Italy who are speech pathologists who routinely practice their trade with these big logs, sawed-off logs in their offices. So there's a log with the round, you know, part on the bottom and it's flat on top. And during their voice training, their voice therapy sessions, patients simply stand on these logs and they try not to fall off. And the therapists sustain that this keeps them flexible and it keeps their mind off of their voices and so they perform better. And so people ask this question empirically. The study that I think is the most straightforward to understand and that I like the best is a study on golf. And if you're wondering, the people who have done these ski simulator and golf and tennis studies that I'll be talking about are all frustrated athletes. And they're trying to figure out why they're not better. In one golf study, one group of subjects was told to pay attention to the swing of their arm for the swing, and the other group of subjects was told to pay attention to the swing of their club, okay? And in fact, the people who paid attention to the club rather than their arm performed better and learned better, right? Paying attention to arm biomechanics was bad. Internal focus of attention was bad. Paying attention to the club, external locus of attention, was good. But some other bright people said, well, we wonder if the, and this effect was replicated several times, on, there was another stabilometer task where there's a little fulcrum in a platform, and your job is to balance on the platform, and your measure of success is how many seconds you can keep the platform in the air before it touches the ground, right? So in one platform study, they had people, one group of subjects paying attention to their feet on the platform, and another group of subjects paying attention to the platform. Okay? The people who paid attention to the platform did better than the people who paid attention to their feet on the platform, right? So people are thinking, yeah, maybe the deal is you have to pay attention to something outside of your body. And that's what's important for performance and learning. But some other bright people came along and they said, we wonder if that's really true. Let's test that hypothesis. So they took tennis this time. One group of subjects, they said, pay attention to the ball as it's approaching you. And the other group of subjects, they said, pay attention to the ball as it's leaving your racket, right? Now, both of those loci of attention are external. So if all you have to do to optimize learning is pay attention to something outside of your body, both of those groups should have done equally well in performance and learning. Not true. The group that paid attention to the ball as it left their racket did better than the group that paid attention to the ball as it approached their racket. Okay? So the notion was, and actually still is, that the bit about paying attention to something outside of your body may not be so much the point, as the point is paying attention to the effects of your biomechanics, right? Now, in singing, what would that be? The effect might be sound, which we often don't want our students to pay attention to, but maybe sound has gotten short shrift in a lot of our teaching. I know, you know, you sound different to yourself than you do to others, all those problems, you sound different in different halls. I very often train people to pay attention to the feeling so that they can carry that feeling with them wherever they are in whatever acoustic environment. But maybe we have been giving sound a short shrift because that is definitely an effect of the biomechanics of what we're doing. But what is another effect that singing pedagogues have had their students pay attention to for centuries? Mask right here. Vibrations in the front of your face, feeling here, right? And that is an effect of the biomechanics. So in other words, if I teach somebody to have a certain posture, a certain neck manipulation, a certain jaw manipulation, a certain breathing pattern, a certain shoulder thing happening, a certain embouchure, a certain tongue posture, a certain palatal posture. Sound familiar? Sounds like a lot of my lessons used to sound. We are paying attention to the bio. We're trying to get them to pay attention to the biomechanics rather than to the effects of those biomechanics. And a very potent effect of biomechanics, I believe, are the sensations in the front of the face and or the sensations of whether you're struggling or whether it's easy. Struggling or ease is an effect of what you're doing. It's not the biomechanics itself. So at any rate, attention to gestures' effects may be vastly better for both performance and motor learning as compared to attention to mechanics. So what does that mean for our training? What are the, if we believe that, what would the implication be for our training? Well, kind of what we just said. And maybe we need to be, and it makes sense too when we think about procedural learning as involving a very large, fast neural processor, cognitive processor, in comparison to declarative learning. If you pay attention to the effect, it's only maybe one thing. Oh, I feel the buzz in the mask, right? We can handle that in consciousness. What we can't handle in consciousness, what we can't compute in consciousness, is all of the degrees of freedom, all the calculations that need to go into what's going to give us that effect, right? So if we pay attention to the effect and we say yes, no, maybe, almost, we give that information to our brain and we trust our brain to make the computations to adjust the biomechanics on the next trial so that on the next trial we'll get closer to target. That makes sense to me from a cognitive, neural sort of perspective. Okay, here's the one that may be a little bit upsetting. We said before that declarative learning depends on associational processes and procedural learning depends on perceptual processes. Now, one type of associational process that occurs very often in singing training has to do with metaphoric imagery. So if I relate the airflow through my mouth to, you know, the summer, the red hot summer wind passing over the roof of my mouth versus the cool blue winter wind passing over the bottom of my mouth, that would count as a metaphoric image. By image, I'm not talking about imagine yourself singing that note. That's not the kind of image. I'm talking about a metaphor. I'm talking about an as-if statement. That counts as associational processing. And metaphoric imagery is widely, widely used in voice training. A couple of years ago, I did a query within ASHA, 95% of responders said that they used imagery, that kind of imagery, sometimes, often, or extensively. And there was only actually one individual who said he never used it, and he said he never used it because I had told him not to. Colton Casper, their textbook from 1996, these are leading speech pathology sort of people, have a section on imagery. In that same month that I was doing this query, a thing came out in the VASTA newsletter about the utility of imagery, and there was an article about the utility of metaphoric imagery in the Journal of Singing as well. Are all of you familiar with VASTA, by the way, the Voice and Speech Trainers Association? It's NAT's equivalent in theater, okay? And they like to pronounce their name as... their acronym is VASTA. And so one time we were having a meeting together with some VASTA and some NATS people, and the NATS people said, so what, we should start calling ourselves NOTS? And then I said, well, maybe for the American Speech Language Hearing Association, we should call ourselves ASHA. So at any rate, we have ASHA, VASTA, and NOTS. All reporting in the same month. I just looked it up. I just went to the most recent journal, and there it was, right? Metaphoric imagery, and so you're all aware that this is widely used in the, just want to make sure that I'm on a really crazy, okay, so when it's, okay, what time is it really? It is 11, okay, good, I've been traveling around a little bit, and I'm a bit confused about what time zone I'm in, and I've been told by Scott McCoy that I will be brutally shut off when my time is over, so I want to make sure that I'm pacing myself. So a question is, given that we use it so extensively, and we use it in voice training more than in any other kind of training I've ever seen, maybe some in instrumental training, but it's really, really seems to be prevalent in voice training. The question is metaphoric imagery somehow helpful in physical training in general and in voice training in particular? I did my dissertation in this domain, and we're writing up another article right now in this domain. And I'll tell you about the voice study that we did. The voice study involved people sitting in front of a computer with a mask over their face, and the mask collected airflow coming through the mouth and therefore through the vocal folds. And they received a word on the screen, And their job was vowel initial word, apple, orange, interesting, ever, always. They received one word at a time, and their job was to say that word with a smooth onset. So not ever or not hever, but ever, right? And that corresponds approximately to 100 milliliters per second of airflow at word onset. So they would say the word, and then they would get feedback from the computer about how they did. So maybe on the first trial, they had 175 milliliters of airflow. On the next trial, they undershot. Here's the target, 100. On the next trial, they overshot. And over trials, they would start to approximate the target more and more, right? And that was evidence of their learning. And we then had them, well, evidence of their performance shifts. And then they took a break, and then they came back so we could assess their learning. And we wanted to see how well they did on words that they had practiced before and how well they did on words that they hadn't practiced before. And but the key to this experiment was that in one group of subjects, people were told to use a metaphoric image. And that is, imagine that your voice is a wave with no beginning and no end. And they were reminded of the image every four or five trials, and they had to rate the extent to which they used the image and the duration and the intensity of the image. And the other group of subjects got no instructions, they just other than just do the task, right? And before we debrief subjects about the experimental hypothesis at the end of the experiment, we asked them to rate those who had had the image. We asked them to rate how much they liked the image. And all of the subjects, we're talking, I think there were about, in that group, 30 subjects in that group. Every one of the subjects said that they liked the image on a scale of from 1 to 5, 5 being they liked it the most. All of them put 4s and 5s. They liked it, and they thought that it helped them. Okay? So they felt that the image was effective. And in fact, they were dead wrong. Here we have error. These are the results for generalized learning, in other words, performance on words that they hadn't practiced before. And the results are similar for item-specific learning. So up is bad because error is up here and down is good. The people who had received the images had a whale of a lot more error than the people who had not received the images relative to the target. Dead wrong. Convinced that this image had worked, right? No ability to introspect into the mechanisms that cause their learning. Again, consistent with the view of motor learning as belonging to a process to which we don't have conscious access. We don't have conscious access. All right. And results were very similar for a hand-eye coordination task that was part of my dissertation. So far, in various permutations of studies, I've run about 700 subjects because I kept thinking I could get it. I kept thinking that I could do something for theory. I kept thinking I could interrupt, you know, theory of motor learning by finding that with voice, there is this unique sort of a domain where metaphoric imaging, perceptual motor domain, where metaphoric imaging does work. And that would be a theoretical problem for the way that people view models of motor learning. 700 subjects, haven't found it. Haven't found it. And I will tell you a little bit later, towards the end of this talk, what happened when we used imagery in an actual voice therapy study, what happened with the outcome of therapy. Concurrent conclusions. At present, there is no empirical evidence that metaphoric images help learning in general physical domains or in voice training in particular. And there is evidence that such images harm learning. Oh, we got that twice. That is very nice. At present, there is, however, evidence that perceptual processing assists learning. So rather than images, perceptual processes, orienting people's attention or allowing people at least the room to engage in perceptual processes. That one's a little bit harder to demonstrate, but the evidence points in that direction. However, I will make this statement. Oddly enough, I am still convinced that certain images in the right hands, in the right way, have the ability to evoke integrated physical behaviors that are driven by primary emotional pathways. And I believe that the studies that I'm the only one who's conducted these studies on this particular issue, that possibly some of the results of the studies are an artifact of the way that the studies are done. You know, when you do science, you have to break things down into little component parts, and sometimes when you do that, you disrupt the way the system would normally function. And I have seen, just recently, I was at a workshop with Kristen Linklater, who's a theater voice and speech trainer, and she's all about images, and I went, you know, 700 subjects, okay, but what I'm seeing here, it is. There's something up with this. There's something up with this. So oddly, I am, again, not quite ready to give up images. But I do favor perceptual processing in my own training. All right, intention. We said that intentionality makes a difference or distinguishes between procedural and declarative learning. There seem to be two types of intention. One type of intention is trying. The other type of intention is going for it, right? And it is, people generally agree that trying is bad, but going for it is good. So don't try for the high note. Go for it, right? Or do it. But let's look at a little bit of the data. There's some interesting data from a video game study where these researchers went into a video games arcade. The study was published in 1984. I don't remember that there were video games arcades in 1984, but I was doing my doctoral study, so maybe I didn't get out much. And they went into this video games arcade with these, you know, little kids, these little boys that were playing video games. And they had the machines rigged so that they could see the performance of these kids without them being in the room. And then they went into the room and told the kids that they were researchers and they were looking at how well they were performing. And they asked the kids to really try hard on the next set of games to see if they could optimize their performance. And what they found was that when the kids really tried hard, their performance got worse, right? And presumably the same thing would be true for learning. However, there's another study by, and there are many studies of this type here that I'm going to tell you about in speech, where the task was, by Cole and Abbs, where the task was to go ba 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 ba, and there was a little stick under the upper lip, and every once in a while, not very systematically, the stick would perturb the stick was on the lower lip. It would perturb the lower lip so that it couldn't come up. Everybody go like this, ba 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 ba. That's what I love about singers. They'll do that. Cognitive scientists won't do that. and so there's this little stick here that every once in a while would keep the lower lip. Did you see that your lower lip is doing the job? That was the point of that. Do it again. Ba 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 ba. Right? It's your lower lip that's doing the job. So every once in a while, this little stick perturbed the lower lip so that it couldn't come up and make contact with the upper lip. Now, what happened on those trials was very interesting. Within about 70 milliseconds of the perturbation, the lower lip came down to compensate and make contact. Now, why is that exciting? That's exciting because we know that that amount of time, is too long for a reflex like, you know, this kind of a thing. There are a lot of corrective movements that happen. You know, if you're walking down the street and you step into a pothole and all of a sudden you right yourself before you even realize you were tripping, right? That is reflexively mediated, and that reflexive mediation goes around the spinal column or around the brainstem, and it takes about 35 milliseconds, right? So this corrective movement was too long for a reflexive one, to be a reflexive one. It was long enough for the signal to go up to the cortex, but it wasn't long enough for the signal to go up to the cortex, make contact with consciousness, a conscious decision, and come back down. Because you need 100 milliseconds to do that at fastest, at very fastest. So it was longer than the reflexive time, but it was shorter than consciousness. So there was some signal that went up to the cortex, had time to go to the cortex, and make contact with some sort of a computational mechanism that generated the correction back down to the lip in a time that did not involve consciousness. Okay? So it occurred outside of consciousness, but it occurred. Why? Because the individual was attempting to achieve that target. Okay? The individual was going for that target. If the individual did not have that lip closure as a target, that corrective mechanism would not have occurred. So going for it is darned important, but trying is a problem. And in fact, there's some very nice data from a golf study on this particular issue. This golfing person, Debbie Cruz, wanted to look at golfers who choked and golfers who didn't choke. And this is very much germane to what we do in performance, right? There are some people who, when they get on stage, they do poorly, and other people, when they get on stage, they do what they can do, or sometimes even better. So she got people who had been playing golf for about the same period of time, I think it was 3 to 5 years, and figured that she'd get some chokers and some non-chokers, took them into the lab and said, okay, everybody take a putt, and everybody did about equivalently on this putt. You call it a putt, right? I don't get out much. And in fact, there's some very nice data from a golf study on this particular issue. This golfing person, Debbie Cruz, wanted to look at golfers who choked and golfers who didn't choke. And this is very much germane to what we do in performance, right? There are some people who, when they get on stage, they do poorly, and other people, when they get on stage, they do what they can do, or sometimes even better. So she got people who had been playing golf for about the same period of time, I think it was 3 to 5 years, and figured that she'd get some chokers and some non-chokers, took them into the lab and said, okay, everybody take a putt, and everybody did about equivalently on this putt. You call it a putt, right? I don't get out much. Then she said, okay, I'm gonna crank up the pressure here a little bit. On this next shot, if you make it, I'll give you $100. If you don't make it, you give me $100. And the group started distinguishing into chokers and non-chokers, right? And this was the same putt, you know, that they had just achieved before. So half of them started not doing very well, and the other half, or the other proportion of them, continued to do very well. And then she said, I'm going to crank it up one more notch on the next shot. $300 if you get it, you pay me $300 if you don't. And by the way, you see that little slit in the wall there? There's some video cameras behind that, and you're going to appear on 2020 tonight, okay? And the chokers fell apart, and the people who didn't choke did continue to do well. Now, the hypothesis was that the people who choked were different from the non-chokers because they got more anxious, right? They got nervous. Because generally, people try to train chokers not to get nervous. Well, that's not what she found at all. Both chokers and non-chokers had the same increase in arousal or anxiety as seen by heart rate and, I believe, galvanic skin response. And they both had an equivalent increase in the amount of total brain activity. So anxiety was not the issue. What the issue was what people did with their anxiety and what they did with their brains when they were under pressure. Here's a pretty picture of the two groups, and no pressure and medium pressure and high pressure, explained on the next slide. The people who choked had an increase in left brain activity. In particular, left brain activity associated with verbal regions, okay, verbalization. So what they were doing is they were giving themselves mechanical instructions, okay? The theme starts coming around again, right? They were giving themselves verbal, mechanical instructions, and they didn't perform well. The people who performed well under pressure, what they were doing with their brains is that they had an increase of brain activity, but it was spread evenly across both sides of the brain. In particular, they had an increase in right brain activity that was consistent with the visual or the perceptual imagery or target, right, as opposed to the verbal instructions. So are you perceiving, when you're going for that high note, are you perceiving where that high note's going to go, or are you giving instructions to support more? Okay, which one are you doing? The target awareness, in fact, when they asked subjects what they were doing, the chokers said that they were giving themselves verbal instructions on what to do, and the non-chokers said that they had target awareness. Okay, they weren't giving themselves verbal mechanical instructions. So translated, this means that perceptual imagery, not metaphoric imagery, and that is target awareness, assists performance and probably learning. In the interest of time, I think we have time to do this one. There's another study that was published on, it wasn't intended to be about intention, but it ended up being about intention. It was a study conducted in Hong Kong on learning a voice task. There were 22 adults who had healthy voices, and they received biofeedback from surface electrodes in this region of their necks. So the electrodes were placed of interest right here between the hyoid and the thyroid cartilages. And they were given a display like this, and they were told to say sentences in Cantonese. And they were told that their job was to minimize the magnitude of this, the amplitudes of this display here. In other words, to minimize the muscular activity in that region. And there were control electrodes that were put right here. And they weren't told anything about those electrodes, and they weren't given any feedback about those electrodes or what have you. And the idea was they wanted to see which type of feedback schedule would optimize learning. In other words, if we give people feedback while they're performing, would that be better for learning than giving people feedback after they finish the sentence? This has been a matter of debate in the motor learning literature, and they wanted to take this debate into the voice domain. So that was their experimental question. And so some subjects received concurrent feedback. Again, they looked at the display, they saw the display as they were speaking the sentences. Some people had the display covered while they were saying each sentence, and then they got to look at the result after the sentence. And the notion from other domains is that we should do better when we look at it afterwards, not during. Okay? And the results were really disappointing. This is the group who had terminal feedback. This is the group who had concurrent feedback. This is at baseline. This is where they started out. This is during their practice. So up is bad. Up means more, larger amplitudes. Down is good. And here's their practice sessions. And then here's like immediate follow-up test and a one-week follow-up test. And if you look at baseline and compare it to the test, which is assessing learning, there was no learning. There was zip. There was no evidence of learning for either group for this site, and that was really disappointing. It looked like they had just done a study and found nothing, and you can't publish studies where you don't find anything. You can't. They can only go into the Journal of Null Results. But, and I was actually co-author on this study, when we looked at the data from the control site, in other words, what they were wanting to find was they were wanting to find learning for this site in one versus the other condition, and they wanted to make sure that the learning was specific to the biofeedback, and so they didn't want to see learning in this other site, which was a control site. They found exactly the opposite. They have these nice curves for both groups who improved equivalently from baseline to follow up. Now, this was a site that they weren't told to manipulate. They received no feedback about it. It was completely ignored. So what was our interpretation? Well, the results showed no learning for the intended and attended laryngeal site, but results did show learning for the unintended and unattended orofacial site. How weird is that? We concluded, and you know, to be verified, but our conclusion was that the results had something to do with twofold: biomechanical instructions at the laryngeal site, and also trying too hard. These people were told what to do biomechanically. All right. So if the other literature that we reviewed is correct, that biomechanical instructions screw up learning, they did here. If they would have just been, and other studies which have just sat people in front of a machine and told them to reduce the amplitudes, but without biomechanical instructions, because these subjects were given biomechanical instructions about how to do it. I forgot to say that. Sorry. It's demonstrated that people can usually learn to reduce those amplitudes. Well, in this case, they were told what to do biomechanically, and learning didn't happen. And number two, these were little students in the Department of Speech Pathology at the University of Hong Kong, and they are really hard little workers. And when you tell them to try to do something, and in fact those words were used, try really hard to do this, they really, really try hard. And so the interpretation of the data is that trying too hard, together with biomechanical instructions, messed up learning. So what does this say about our voice training models? Probably what we already know, and that is that trying too hard is not a good thing, but intending is a good thing, and especially intending in the sense of target awareness. Where are you going? It's interesting. At one point, every summer I work in Denver at this Summer Vocology Institute run by Ingo Tietze. And I was having dinner one night with some friends whose son, 16-year-old son, was about to go on an international golf tournament. And this kid is really hot. I mean, he is really, really, really hot. In fact, I think he placed second in the whole world in his age category or something. But at any rate, we were at dinner the night before he was leaving for this competition, and we were talking about some of this stuff, and he goes, you know, it's so interesting because I was saying, before I go to a high note, and you probably all have this experience, before I go to a high note, I know whether I'm going to get it or not. Don't you know it before you get there? Almost all the time. What's that? That's target awareness. And sometimes you get the wrong target in your head and you just don't have time to get the right one in your head and you blow it. And he was saying, it's so interesting, before I even swing or when I'm just lifting my club, I can see the path of the ball. I can absolutely see the path of the ball. And I know when it's going to go in. And so that's kind of what we're talking about, I think, in terms of intention, a type of intention that is probably very healthy for both performance and learning. Consciousness. We said that another distinguishing feature between declarative and procedural learning has to do with consciousness. The findings for consciousness follow from the preceding. So let's review where we've been before we go where we're going to go. Attention to mechanics is bad. Attention to gestures effects is good. Use of metaphors, metaphoric images may be bad. Use of perceptual processes is good. Trying too hard is bad. Intending is good. One of the nicest studies that I have come across in terms of consciousness was conducted by a fellow named Dr. Altmuller at a theater conservatory in Hamburg. He's a neuroscientist, cognitive neuroscientist, and I have no idea how this theater conservatory managed to come up with the money to hire a cognitive neuroscientist, but he does great work, and they sure did. He looked at this business of training children musically declaratively, okay, verbally, versus training them procedurally. And the task was a perceptual one. Basically, these were children who were male and female, age 13 and 14. They were musically naive. They had no prior musical training, but they all had similar aptitudes on some standardized Gordon's AMMA test for musical aptitudes. And their job was to learn to distinguish between to identify balanced and closed musical phrases. So a balanced and closed musical phrase at the very simplest level, and I know that they used stimuli that were a lot more complex than this, balanced and closed would be okay? Symmetric, closed, at the end, you feel like it's done. And unbalanced and unclosed would be That's neither balanced nor is it closed. And I was kind of expecting a little applause for that, but that's okay. He had three groups of subjects. In one group of subjects, they were taught the task verbally. So this was declarative training, as we do probably in most of our voice lessons. Do this, do this, do that. It wasn't biomechanical because the task was perceptual rather than a mechanical task. But they were explained verbally how to recognize these phrases. In another group, they received no such instructions. They were trained procedurally instead. And the procedural training, I would have loved, I have this image in my mind of these little German kids, they probably had lederhosen on, and, you know, of doing body movements, okay? So it was an embodiment sort of a training. La, 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 la. Everybody, you know, rosy, rosy, down on the ground sort of a thing. And so they embodied the phrases, and they were given no other instructions on how to do the task. And then there was a control group who received no training. Behavioral measures as well as electroencephalographic measures were made before training, after 5 weeks of training when training stopped, and after 1 year of training. The behavioral results were that immediately following training, both groups improved on the task and they improved equivalently. So it didn't make a hill of beans of difference if they had received the procedural, the declarative verbal training, or the procedural training. However, 1 year after training, the people who had learned declaratively did poorly, and the people who had learned procedurally had continued to do well. And this fits what we know about declarative versus procedural learning, and that is declarative learning is very vanishing. There are statistics that if you took a class last year, there is great likelihood that you only remember 10% of the material, even if you got an A in the course. I mean, I don't even remember a lot of courses that I took, right? And declarative learning is very rapidly vanishing. But procedural learning is very stable over time. You know, riding a bike sort of a thing. Literally, if you haven't been on a bike in 20 years, but you used to ride it, you get back on and you go, right? That is characteristic it's a hallmark of procedural learning, whereas declarative learning declines over time. So this is yet another reason for us to be interested in procedural models for training, sensory processing for training, rather than trying to train people up verbally and biomechanically, because when we train people biomechanically, it's usually by way of words, right? And in fact, the control group, I believe, didn't show any improvement in the task. And it was also the case that I think this was at 5 weeks follow-up. This is baseline and 5 weeks follow-up, I believe, yeah. In terms of the brain patterns, what was interesting was that at the time point at which both groups had learned equivalently, it was found that they had used different parts of the brain to do so, right? So you can learn the same task. You can learn declaratively, okay? But you're going to use different brain patterns than you're going to use if you learn procedurally. So what was seen was that in the declarative learning group, with learning, they had an increase in activation over the left frontal region, which makes sense because that's the verbal, analytical, conscious, you know, sort of a region. And they had a moderate increase over the whole left hemisphere. So this was very much a left hemisphere sort of a type of learning. Procedural learning, which at that time point was the same behaviorally as same at the same level as the declarative learning, had pronounced increase over the right frontal region and posterior parietal region. Right frontal has a lot to do with gestalt, appreciation of intonation, melodics, prosody. And they also had increases of parietal regions over both hemispheres. The parietal regions are responsible for somatosensory sensation, right? So, and the control group actually had no change from baseline, or they had a little bit of a reduction in brain activity because of what is called habituation to the procedures. So, current conclusions around this is that a verbal approach to training increases verbal-related activity in the brain and leads to poor long-term learning, whereas a procedural approach to training increases right hemisphere activity and bilateral sensory-related activity and leads to better long-term learning. What does this say about our voice training models? It says that maybe we need, again, to be oriented towards experiential learning much more than verbal analytical learning. And I will say that it's interesting because over the past 20 years or so, more and more voice teachers have become interested in voice science, which I think is very good. I mean, that's what I do for a living, and that's what gets me my paycheck, so I have to say that. No, it is good. It's a good thing. But one of the dangers that I have seen associated with this is what many of you may complain about or be suspicious about. And so here's a little soapbox. The soapbox is that in my general approach to training, I just distinguish, as I said at the beginning, between the what of training, what's the biomechanical target, okay, or what's the acoustic target, and the how. If you know a lot about the what of training, if you know a lot about voice science, as some voice scientists do, but you don't know anything about the how, you're sunk, okay? You're really not any further along than if you, not much further along than if you don't know anything about the what. The error that we've made as a field of singing teachers who have become interested in voice science is that we've thought that knowing more about the what, we could take that what, information about the what, into the studio, tell people about it, and be better teachers. That's not true. It's not true, not true, not true, not true, not true. Because if you know something about voice science in the sense of biomechanics and acoustics, it doesn't mean that you know anything about the how. That's in a different department on campus, right? It's literature that's non-intersecting. And as trainers and teachers, we have to know about the how at least as much as about the what. And I often feel like when I'm doing voice training, I often feel like, is it a duck that moves along? Oh, I'm so pitiful. That moves along the water and it just glides and all the activity is going on underneath, but you don't say it's a duck. Okay. For some reason that didn't sound right. When I'm in a studio or a therapy room, that's what I feel like. I feel like underneath the surface, this stuff about biomechanics is going on in my head. Like, I want this to happen, I want that to happen, I want that to happen. But on top, things have to look very different on the surface. They have to look very, very different. It has to look very procedural. It has to look very intuitive. The person needs to not know that that's what's going on in my head. And I'll say also that it's interesting, the parallel or the sequitur to that, the corollary, is that also voice training, teaching singing, is itself a procedure, right? Is itself a procedure. And the way that we're ultimately going to learn how to do this, and that you all have learned how to do it well, is by doing it procedurally much more than analytically. So there's a lot going on in your procedure. But I think that's the paradox of what I'm talking. I'm telling you analytically what you need to know about the how, which is that you need not to learn it analytically. I don't know. I haven't solved that problem yet. But what's interesting, one of the things, back to this particular study, one of the things that's interesting that Altenmuhr has suggested about his findings is that he says it's known that trained musicians tend to have an increase in left hemisphere activity when listening to music. Trained musicians tend to process music much more analytically and verbally and analytically than untrained musicians. And his suggestion, based on these and other data, is that maybe that's an artifact of the way they were trained, right? So these little kids who were trained verbally and analytically did have an increase in left hemisphere activity. But the kids who were trained procedurally did not, and they learned better. So if we want to say, look, I've been teaching for 20, 30 years, and I've been, you know, teaching biomechanically and analytically for 20 or 30 years, and I have, you know, several students who have made it to the, you know, the semifinals of the Metropolitan Opera auditions, well, maybe they would have even done better. If, you know, people do learn analytically and verbally, but think of what they would do if we trained them procedurally is the suggestion. All right. Laws of practice. I'm going to go through these relatively quickly to leave some time for some questions. This part of stuff that I'm going to be talking about is very practical, and it has to do with how to structure sessions in a way that may optimize learning. We have a series of studies that show us that manipulations that enhance immediate performance during the training session often harm learning. I had my finger in front of it. Good. So things that you can do to make people sound better in their lessons may screw up learning. Things that you do that may make them sound horrible in their lessons may enhance their learning. Example, if you tell people often how they're doing, good, good, not quite, okay, short up there, not, turn it a little bit that way, that will improve their performance, mess up their learning. Right? Opposite. If you keep your mouth shut, if you keep your face flat like Mark Madsen did, Mark doesn't know any of this literature, he just did a lot of this stuff intuitively, that often messes up performance. I had bad lessons, right? But my learning was good. Number two, if you give people feedback while they're performing, you can boost their performance. Come on, come on. Okay? That'll increase their performance, but it will mess up their learning. If you keep a flat face on it until after their performance and then give them feedback, they won't perform as well in their lessons, but they will learn better. If you are working on several parameters at once, if you block them, in other words, if you work on posture first and breathing second and, you know, jaw third, people will do better during the training trials, but when you ask them to put it all together, they won't do as well. And the opposite can be said, turning things in the opposite direction. What I didn't put on here is part whole practice. The practice of component, in the motor learning literature, the practice of component parts of movements has value, according to the literature, if those movements are going to be run off serially, one after another. But if those movements, so arguably the golf swing, right? It has discrete moments. But if there's a movement which has component parts which are going to be performed together, like learning to you know, shift and do the clutch at the same time, practice of component parts actually messes up learning. It's only practice of the whole integrated that enhances learning, because what you're learning is really relationships, temporal relationships across different component parts. And the only way that you can practice those relationships is when you practice them together, right? Now, singing, once we've started, okay, fine, vocal folds come together first. You take a breath first, vocal folds come together, so that's serial. After that, and forgets this articulation part, but vocalization itself is largely an activity where all of the systems are engaged at the same time, right? Breathing, larynx, what's the system up here? Vocal tract. They're all engaged at the same time. And so the literature on part whole practice would say that there is the most value in practicing all of these component parts at the same time rather than breaking them down into component parts. So there may be little value to practicing breathing in isolation, although I agree, for some people you have to, they just can't get it and you have to, you know, break it down and then put it back in. But wherever possible, the literature says that we ought to be having people practicing their breathing in the context of making voice, because what you're learning is actually a relationship between what the breath system is doing and what the vocal folds and the vocal tract are doing, right? And finally, non-variable practice is doing the same thing over and over and over again. Okay, same song over and over and over, same phrase over and over and over, which is kind of like block practice as well. That will enhance your immediate performance, but it will decrease your learning. And the opposite is true for variable practice. If you practice things in different, well, actually a better example of this is non-variable practice would be always practicing in the studio. Okay, you go there for your lessons for a semester. You have four songs that you're learning or five songs that you're learning. You have just those songs that you do, and you always sing in the studio or maybe in a practice hall. Variable practice or a practice room. Variable practice would be singing those pieces or more pieces in the studio, outside under the trees, in the practice room, on a stage, okay, at somebody's house for a party. That would be variable practice. That messes up immediate performance, but it enhances generalization to new venues very strongly. I'm not going to have time to go through the data on these all of these studies. I'm going to flip through them, and I'm going to go to the end here, which is on a voice study that looks at a couple of the things that we've talked about. I developed a program, a voice therapy program, that's called Lesak Madsen Resonant Voice Therapy, in honor of my my favorite speech and voice trainer, Arthur Lesak, and Mark Madsen, whom I told you about before. And they're quite a pair, because Arthur stands about 5'2", and Mark is about 6'3", so they're quite a pair. All right, what we did here was we had 40 people with lesions on their vocal folds, 40 adults with lesions on their vocal folds attributable to voice use, right? And I was going to give them all of, I was going, I we gave, I wasn't a therapist in the study, I directed the study, we gave all 40 subjects training in resonant voice. Now, resonant voice looks like this, if it will play. Where's my little cursor? Oops, where's my cursor? There it is. It will play. It's thinking. Okay, so you see that there's a little bit, that's normal female voice, looking right there, there's a little bit of a gap. Here it's zero gap, or very close to zero gap. Don't look behind there, I'm just looking at the tip of the vocal processes. This is breathy, okay, where there's a big gap. And the next one will be pressed, which is nasty. Don't ever do it. Okay, and we'll look at it again. The second phonation mode is the one that we were training them in. So that's normal female, adult female, a little bit of a gap. Resonant voice with pretty full closure, about a half a millimeter gap. That's it. That's it, resonant voice. That's it, resonant voice. Okay, we can turn that off now. So they were all going to get trained in resonant voice for use in speech. And the reason that they were getting trained in resonant voice for speech is, very briefly, that particular configuration, which is associated with feelings, vibratory sensations in the front of your mouth, and easy voice. That's how I define resonant voice in my work. Vibrations in the front of your face, easy voice. It's resonant. If it's head voice, fine. If it's falsetto, fine. If it's chest voice, fine. If it's loud, fine. If it's high, fine. If it's low, fine. Many different resonant voice is a family of voice qualities, but they all have that particular characteristic of vibrations in the front of the face in the context of easy voice, not much effort. And that is a wonderful thing to train people to do, which is actually a classical singing. It comes straight out of classical singing. Wonderful thing for people to do, because when the vocal folds, to do that, I won't go into the explanation for why, but to do that, your vocal folds have to be barely touching or barely separated by about a half a millimeter. And when you do that, if you keep everything else constant, subglottic pressure and fundamental frequency, you maximize the acoustic output, so you get the strongest possible voice. You relatively minimize vocal fold impact stress, so it's protective of the voice. You could get a lot of bang for your buck. Strong, clear voice, a lot of harmonics, you don't hurt yourself. And when you take the ratio of output divided by impact stress, output good, impact stress bad, resonant voice falls, here's that curve, resonant voice falls within the region about 0.5 or 0.6, 0.7 millimeters of separation between the vocal processes that optimizes the relationship between output strong, impact stress low. So they were all getting training, they all received training in resonant voice. But the way that we trained them varied. And specifically, here's what we did. 40 subjects. Half of the subjects received sensory training, okay? So pay attention to the vibrations in the front of your face, pay attention to the ease. And everything was about those vibrations. It's just wonderful. Because it feels so good. And the other half of subjects received metaphors. And specifically, we use the metaphors that Arthur Lesak uses in his training protocols. And that is, imagine that your voice is a Stradivarius, okay? A violin, a cello, a what have you. So it was very much metaphoric imagery to obtain resonant voice. And within each one of those groups, half of the subjects got non-variable practice, or limited variability practice. They practiced making resonant voice on some words, on some sentences, and in conversation, in quiet, in the therapy room. And the other half of subjects got variable practice. They practiced resonant voice not only primarily on the sounds. This non-variable group got practice on more, many, my, much, and then quiet conversation. These guys got practice on resonant voice using all voiced consonants. So Zorro, may, never, etc., all voiced consonants, in many, many different phonetic contexts, and in many different physical and emotional and speech type contexts. So in quiet, on the telephone, loud over a distance in a room like this, in background noise, in a, you know, in a simulated bar or church bazaar or whatever, you know, sort of a situation, in an emotional context, and when challenged by other people who were not using very good voice production. And so we had 10 subjects in each cell. And other than that, the programs were identical. I won't go more into that, but they were very structured programs, and there's the video again. And we already did that. All right. And what we did was we made a variety of measures at baseline, and 1 week after therapy, they got 8 sessions in 4 weeks, by the way, 1 week after therapy and 2 months after therapy. The primary outcome that we were looking at is called the Voice Handicap Index, which is a voice-related quality of life tool that indicates how people feel their quality of life is in relation to voice. Am I happy with my voice? Am I functioning with it? Do I have pain? Blah, 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 blah. And so that was the primary outcome measure. And then we made secondary outcome measures, which were voice quality, the appearance of the larynx, and vocal efficiency. And I'll be going over these data here today, the primary outcome measure. First of all, we also had ancillary measures, which were patient satisfaction and clinician bias. Patient satisfaction measures, for those measures, we asked people to fill out questionnaires that said, to what extent did you like the therapy that you got? To what extent did your voice change since the beginning of therapy? To what extent do you think that your therapy made your voice change? And in these four groups, the patient responses were identical. I mean, they were so close it wasn't even funny. On a 5-point scale, they were hovering around 3.7, okay? They were identical. So in all four groups, patients thought that the therapy was good, they liked the therapy, and they thought that the therapy helped their voice improve to the same extent. We also asked the clinicians if they had biases, and just briefly, one of the clinicians liked sensory better than imagery, the other had the opposite, and there weren't any strong tendencies in terms of variable versus non-variable practice. So there was no strong evidence of patient preference, there was no strong evidence of clinician bias in the results. What happened? What happened was 1 week after therapy, the people who were the people who received, this is the improvement in the voice handicap index, so up is good here. The people who received sensory instructions, in other words, pay attention to the vibrations, did better, had greater improvements than people who used the images, right? So perceptual processing instructions were better than imagery. You know, again, this was another 40 subjects added to my 700, trying to show that imagery helps. Again, not there. And people who had variable practice did much better than people who had non-variable practice. So in singing instruction terms, that would be people who only practice in the studio and in the practice room might not do very well on the stage if they haven't practiced there. And this little data point is interesting. People who got images, who were told to use images which they liked, okay, and practiced only in the therapy room with a limited corpus of stuff, actually got worse after treatment than they had been at baseline, although their patient satisfaction questionnaires didn't reflect that. They weren't aware of that, right? And I don't know about singing training, but in speech pathology, this is what most speech pathologists do, right? This is what we do. We use images, and we work with people in a therapy room. That's what we do, and that got people worse. And we had qualitatively similar findings at 2-month follow-up. There's a little bit of a difference here that I won't get into. I'll be happy to discuss with anybody if you'd like. So the point is, I'm going to go through all of this and go to the end here. Summary and conclusions. Biomechanical goals, which we learn from voice science or from our prior voice teachers or from our own experience, are not the only relevant parameter to consider in voice or speech therapy or training. Right? The target, in other words, the what of training is not the only relevant thing that we need to be considering, although I think the what is very important. But we as teachers have to know, should know, ideally should know something about the how. And I know that a lot of us do and a lot of you do. Also, learning, in fact, is critical. And I am going to stop there. Here I'm talking a little bit about some stuff that's more relevant for people with injury. So I am going to stop there. We have about 5 minutes for questions. I'm sorry if I stopped very abruptly. Yes. I believe so. Yeah, and there's always the... Yes, I'll repeat the question. She wanted to know if modeling, you know, giving people examples of what you want them to do, would fall under the category of perceptual training. I do think so, yes. Of course, the caution is, are they going to model your sound, or are they going to copy your sound or your biomechanics? But you know what? I think especially if you, lots of times if you mime it bigger than life, what you're wanting them to do, I think you can get away from them copying your sound, or you can reduce that particular problem. Another thing that you can do that is very helpful, and I do it a lot, is negative practice. So if somebody's doing, oh, well, I'll tell you the four steps. There's a little piece, and last year at Summer Vocology Institute, they helped me make a little song out of it. The pieces are scan, gel, show, tell, negative practice, scan, gel, show, tell, negative practice. There was a song about it. Scan is scan your body for anything that feels comfortable or uncomfortable, or especially here, you know, where do you feel vibration? Scan. Gel is use your hands to fix problems when you have to address something biomechanical rather than telling people to do it. So Mark, for example, didn't tell me to loosen up my neck, right? He came over and adjusted it for me, right? And that would fall under, you know, perceptual training. By the way, a lot of this stuff where I'm coming from originally came from the inner game of tennis, not the inner game of music, inner game of golf, inner game of tennis. Pick it up, read it today if you haven't. Very powerful, because it'll give you a lot of examples. Scan, gel, show would be a modeling. Tell is the last thing that I do. But negative practice is when somebody's doing something you don't want them to do, get them to do it a little bit worse. Because if they can do it worse, that brings it under their control, and they can often find the switch that is required to go in the opposite direction. Yes? You don't. You say, check it out. You use discovery language rather than, you use exploratory language rather than prescriptive language. Check it out. What does that feel like? What does that feel like? You know, so if somebody goes, and they say, that feels perfectly comfortable. Okay. You know, so keep it in the, and theater is much better in my experience than singing. The theater tradition is much better at this than the singing pedagogy. Yes. Like your what?
Like the notes coming out like you're above a machine.
Bubble. Okay, bubble machine. Gotcha. Well, you know, that's a fascinating question, because the images that we have given people, let me see if that's true. Make it like your voice is a wave. In my hand-eye coordination studies, the images were connected to the biomechanics. I'm not sure they were in the voice studies that I did. And we piloted, we got the image, the wave image that we use was taken from a national survey of Asha, Vasta, and Nats. And that was the most recurring one. And we piloted on 20 subjects who felt that they liked it the best. And so I think it's very possible that there may be something up with imagery that we're not capturing here. Because it's, you know, sometimes in the right hands, it just seems too compelling. But it may also be that, as we found in our studies, subjects liked it. Subjects thought it helped. And when we actually measured whether it did, it didn't. So I'm really perplexed. But it's an open question for me. That's part, what he was asking, how kinesthetic or proprioceptive information comes in. That falls under the rubric of perceptual processing. And I would say that the data would suggest that as long as those sensations or those perceptions are oriented towards the outcome rather than the production mechanism, you should have a favorable situation. That's what that is. Does anybody else have anything burning? Yes. Good question. Yeah. Talking about two kinds of images here. One bad, another one good. The one that, at least in our data, in our 700 subjects, has not panned out is as-if imagery, metaphors. Imagine that, well, the one that was used before, bubbles coming out of your mouth. Okay? Bubbles are not coming out of your mouth. Okay? Imagine that your voice is a wave. Anytime you use the word or could use the word imagine, that's the kind of imagery that has not worked well. Anytime you say, well, I'm sorry, and not imagine, as if. Anytime you could insert the words as if. Imagine that your voice is as if a wave, okay? As if it were a wave. But on the other hand, if you imagine the literal note that you are about to hit, that is a direct imagining. And it's shown in neural imaging studies that imagining a physical behavior activates exactly the same neurophysiological mechanisms as doing it.
So that's what your friend's son, who's a golf player,
right? Visualization is great, and it's shown over and over in athletics that visualization is great. And in our case, it's not so much visualization as it is auditorization, right? Or you can think ahead what it's going to feel like, right? That kind of imagery, I have every sense, is very powerful. Yeah. Oh, yeah, and I'll just repeat the question, and then we'll have to end. The question was whether people who try too hard are that way because they're basically that way or because of their past education. And I would imagine that that both are true in varying proportions for different people. And I know that we can help them to shift because I was definitely a trier, and Mark broke it right out of my body. But you have to stick with it. People are going to be discouraged, and they might not think you're as good of a teacher in the interim, except by your reputation. So that's where our egos need to be strong. So I promised that I would not go over. If anybody has any questions, please do approach me. Thank you so much.